A Midnight Poetic by Christine Haggerty, read by Jillian Joy. My darkness soars on raven's wings, black and slick with dreaming, while an equine rides on hell's vast tides, and the demons follow, screaming, screaming while I'm dreaming on the shores of hell's vast tides. The goblin king of shadowed things flies down on scales, creeping. Here, my child, he says with a smile, his arms outstretched and reaching, reaching while I'm creeping from the goblin king's vain smile. Be my queen, growls the goblin king, red claws alive and gleaming. I'll gift you lies and boiling skies and a tower for your keeping, a tower for my keeping beneath the goblin king's dark skies. I meet his eyes with wounded pride, my feathers soiled and seeping. No goblin bride, but queen I'll be, the jewel of hell's dark dreaming. Soiled and dreaming, feathers seeping, still hell's dark queen I'll be. Sharp teeth spread wide reflect hell's tide, and he grasps at me, sneering. Such a pretty thing with broken wings, I'll take you, cold and fearing. Fears sharply sneering at my pretty broken wings. Hell's equine ride and his nightmare bride pound the edge of midnight steaming. I spread my wings for the goblin king, each feather black and gleaming. Steaming, blackened wings spread before the goblin king. Sweet, foolish soul, my goblin king, I'll not cower from your sneering for darkened things with broken wings. Strengthen fiercely in hell's keeping, and the king sneering cowers before my darkened wings. I beat my wings against hell's sky, and his nightmare bride flees screaming. Black shadows churn where ravens fly, and my demons rise from dreaming. Nightmares flee screaming where my demon shadows fly. For my wings are made of burning lies, each vein cruel black and gleaming. Deep hatred feeds each sharpened shaft, love's deconstruction sickly bleeding, black veins gleaming while deconstruction bleeds the shaft. I soar through hell on raven's wings, the queen of death and dreaming. My nightmare rides on blood-fed tides, and my demons follow, screaming, screaming while I'm dreaming on hell's bloodied nightmare tides.
Welcome to episode 17, In the Telling's Halloween Special, with listeners submitted stories and poems to indulge in the spooky and beautiful aspects of the season. We started with A Midnight Poetic by Christine Haggerty and read by Jillian Joy, a hellishly delicious poem about a dark queen. Each story is its own chapter in the episode, with chapter breaks listed by time in the show notes. Fans of the Billy Blacksmith series will particularly enjoy Aesop's First Halloween, A Blacksmith Legacy Story, by Ben Ireland, read by Liz Christensen. The Ghost of Clipper Bullion Mine, by Lauren Mitchell Lambert, read by Richard Wilson, is a classic Western ghost story for over a campfire. The Full Moon Festival, by Brianna Bredor, read by Liam Neary, is a lovely fall-themed science fiction romance. The Burgle, by Candace J. Thomas, read by Kirsten Hallows, provides a frighteningly imaginative answer to what is under your child's bed. While The Creature, by Luke Howiter, read by Liz Christensen, will keep you worried about what is watching you while you sleep. Thank you to everyone who submitted work for this special October episode. Happy Halloween, everyone.
Aesop's First Halloween, A Blacksmith Legacy Story by Ben Ireland, read by Liz Christensen. And they just hand you candy? Aesop asked. Billy nodded. Yep, just like that. Aesop's eight eyes widened as he absorbed what Billy had told him. And that's the treat part? Billy nodded again. He was getting a kick out of how enthralled Aesop was with the concept of Halloween, especially trick-or-treating. Aesop hadn't heard about Halloween before because he was a spider demon stranded on Earth after an army of demons tried to invade. The attack failed, and the gateway between the human and demon realms was broken in the process. As a result, Aesop was stuck here. Aesop lived in a small apartment between Sugar House and Bleakwood with a huge bat demon, Silanthiel, a.k.a. Seth, who also happened to be a good guy. Aesop wasn't actually part of the invading army. He just snuck through because living at his home in the demonic realm sucked. He was a runt. At only 3 feet tall, he was the favorite punching bag of his several dozen brothers and sisters. And though most humans would scream in horror at his appearance, Aesop was just happy to be somewhere he wasn't getting demon swirlies every night. Billy knew what it was like to be singled out because you looked different than everyone else. He'd always been the fat kid. So he had a soft spot for Aesop, despite his 8 legs. Billy, Ashlia, and Grayson came over when they could to keep Aesop company. The small spider demon got pretty lonely without any other friends, and because he could never leave the apartment. Candles burned in several holders in the room, painting the scene an odd purple color. The place smelled dusty. The furniture, a couch and a matching armchair, looked really old, but were still nice. The whole back wall of the apartment was a huge bookshelf. A genuine record player sat in the corner. Whatever Seth was listening to last still rested on the turntable. The four of them had been sitting in a circle for 30 minutes now, discussing the true meaning of Halloween. Aesop had asked about Halloween because he had noticed all the spider webs and human skeletons sprouting up around the apartment complex, and it reminded the demon of home. Billy felt like he was explaining Halloween to someone who'd been living on a different planet, which, now Billy thought about it, wasn't too far from reality. Aesop rubbed his mandibles together hungrily, thinking about candy. Seth's parrot-sized messenger wyvern listened from her perch by the bookshelf. She squawked and bobbed her head in agreement, her white scales shimmering in the purple candlelight. "It was awesome," Grayson said, adjusting his glasses while he took a sniff from his allergy spray. "A whole bag of candy that's just yours. Nobody can tell you what to do with it." "You never had to share?" Ashlia asked. Her black hair was streaked orange, purple, and green in celebration of the season. It matched her black t-shirt and neon pleated skirt. "Mom made my brothers and sisters pool all our candy and made sure everyone got the same amount." "As an only child, I'm not familiar with the concept of sharing," Grayson said, smirking. Ashlia socked him on the arm. "Is it normal to make everyone share, though?" "I don't think so," Billy said. "I'd share with you." Aesop had a dreamy look on his hairy face. "I'd make sure you all got the best candy. The only things my brothers shared with me were bruises." "We're a little old to go," Ashlia said. "It's been a few years since we last went." "There's an age limit?" Aesop asked, his face falling. Ashlia patted Aesop on the head. "I'm afraid so." Grayson showed his teeth in a sympathetic expression. "Well, it's not a precise, rigid rule." Aesop picked at the rug under him with a claw. "I'm about 85 years old. "How many demon years does that make?" Ashlia asked. Aesop shrugged his 8 shoulders. "I don't know. But Silanthiel called me a moody teenager once." "Really?" Grayson said. "Maybe you're not too old." "You definitely look the part," Billy said. "Hell of a costume." "Maybe we could sneak you out," Grayson offered, "for old time's sake." "We are totally too old," Ashlia waved her finger between Grayson and herself. "And Billy straight up looks like an adult." A smile broke across Grayson's face. "I know one kid who is trick-or-treating age, and he'd be cool with a demon spider tagging along." Ashlia tugged on Grayson's sleeve and they leaned to the side. "I don't want you getting his hopes up. There is no way Seth would be okay with this." Grayson was beaming at this point. "We just don't need to tell him what's happening." "Seth lives here. He's going to notice if we take his roommate," Ashlia said. "Maybe," Grayson bit his lip. "He's not here now." Billy was becoming increasingly alarmed at what it sounded like Grayson was saying. "I don't know, Gray. We keep Aesop here for his safety. There's nothing good out there for a tiny demon spider." "Except candy," Grayson said as he clapped his hands and pointed at Aesop. "We're taking you." Aesop sprung off the carpet and did a bouncing, jig-like dance while clicking his front claws together. Ashlia glanced at Billy, looking bewildered. "Who is taking him?" Billy said. "We're too big and old." "Junior is." Grayson knelt in front of Aesop. "Can you get to the Bluin's house at 7 tomorrow?" "Belf again," Aesop called to the messenger wyvern. "Could you help me get to the Bluin's tomorrow at 7? As a messenger wyvern, Belfigan had the ability to open portals to travel vast distances instantaneously. She was one of the especially talented ones that had the ability to not only carry actual messages through her portal, but she was strong enough to carry other living beings if she felt like it. Belphegan chuffed out an irritated breath. It didn't sound like a no. Thank you, Aesop said. He turned to Grayson. What's 7 mean? Oh, Grayson said, 7 hours after midday. Aesop said. I think I can do that.
There's still the matter of his costume, Billy said.
He doesn't need one, Grayson replied. Disguise, then, Ashleigh suggested. Grayson pinched Aesop's cheeks. He's perfect. Look at him. Aesop smirked, and Billy swore he could see the spider blushing under the dark gray fur on his cheeks.
He looks like a demon, Billy said. Like an actual, literal demon. Nobody's going to think that's a costume.
I have a plan. Grayson tousled the fur on Aesop's head. Get ready to trick or treat.
Aesop wrapped his bony legs around Grayson's neck and gave him a big hug.
Thank you. Billy felt in his gut that this was probably an awful idea, but Grayson had practically promised the poor little guy, and he couldn't stand the thought of letting him down. Aesop never, ever got to go out and do anything fun. He'd been living in the apartment for almost 2 whole years and had barely been through the door. And Grayson wasn't an idiot. He probably had a really good plan.
Maybe. Hopefully, Billy thought.
When they finally left the apartment, Billy took a deep breath of the chilly October air. He loved it when the days got cooler. He was a big guy and was never comfortable in the heat. But his neck prickled as he stepped out into the landing, and he looked up at the moon hanging in the sky. This wasn't going to go well, but he couldn't let Aesop down. And just an hour of trick-or-treating couldn't hurt. At 6:50 Halloween night, Billy, Ashleigh, and Grayson showed up at Junior Bluen's house as planned. They let themselves in and headed down the hallway to the sewing room. Even though he was just 12, Junior had taken up sewing as a hobby and evidently planned to spend Halloween night making clothes instead of going out. They were probably doing him a favor forcing him to trick-or-treat. Ashleigh knocked once on the door and opened it. Junior was leaning over the sewing machine, his thin fingers skillfully guiding the fabric under the needle. Junior didn't look much like anyone in his family. His mom, dad, and sister were all tall and athletic. Junior was a bony little guy with his black hair cut close to the scalp. His big sister was into shooting, cheerleading, and demon slaying when she had time. Junior would prefer to sew instead of going out and enjoying Halloween. The room was pretty big, but it felt muffled from all the bolts of cloth stacked up against the walls. An open wardrobe stood by the window, revealing several dresses hanging on hangers, and shelves covered with dozens of mismatched hats.
"Hey, guys," Junior said without looking up. "I know I said I'd go, but this is going to take me all night."
"But you promised," Grayson replied.
"I'm 12, Junior said. "I'm a little old for trick-or-treating."
"You'll regret that," Grayson sat on the table next to Junior. "This is your last year before people start giving you crap. Trust me."
"I'm not going."
Junior pulled the fabric off the machine, snipped the thread, and tied it with a quick, practiced movement. "I got this new dress pattern I'm working on. I was planning on staying here to sew. I got this new dress pattern I'm working on. I was planning to stay here and sew."
"You'd choose sewing over candy?" Billy asked.
Junior nodded.
"The thing is," Grayson said, "is that we've promised our friend he can go tonight, and we're too big to take him on our own."
"You don't have friends," Junior turned in his chair and folded his arms.
"Who is he anyway? And why couldn't you tell me about it over the phone if I know him?"
Grayson snapped his fingers.
"He'll be here any second. Let me find him."
And he rushed out of the room. There was an awkward 20 seconds of silence as Billy, Junior, and Ashleigh looked at each other. A loud popping sound echoed from deeper in the house, which meant Belphegan had arrived with Aesop. Grayson let out a squeal of surprise, then said something that Billy couldn't understand. His thumping footsteps echoed down the hall before Grayson rushed back into the room. In his hand, he held a remote control that looked like it came from an RC car. Grayson smiled broadly, showing all his teeth.
"I'm controlling my robot now," he called.
Aesop pushed the door open, moving with bouncy robot-like movements.
"I'm a robot spider," he announced in a jolting demon voice. "I'm not a scary demon."
Junior jumped backwards onto the desk. "Holy!" he exclaimed. He stared at Aesop for a second before recognition replaced the fear on his face.
"That's Aesop. I haven't met you yet."
"I'm not Aesop," Aesop said, grinning madly. "I am a robot."
Junior gawked at the demon.
"This isn't going to work. Nobody's going to think he's a remote-control spider."
"Sure they will," Grayson said. "It's dark out, and people are expecting crazy stuff. This is going to be great."
"This could be the worst idea you've ever had," Ashleigh shook her head slowly.
"Come on, robot spider," Grayson said.
Lead the way.
Aesop marched out of the room, moving with jolting movements.
I don't have a costume, Junior said.
Guess you're the spider tamer, Ashlia suggested.
Guess so, Junior said.
He sorted through the wardrobe for a second before emerging with a safari-worthy hat. He slipped the hat on his head and followed Grayson out of the room.
He must have wanted to go more than he let on, Billy said, startled by Junior's apparent sudden change of heart. We barely talked him into it.
All 12-year-olds want to go trick-or-treating, Ashlia followed Aesop, Grayson, and Junior into the hall. But they're not sure if they're too cool or not.
So are we just going down the street? Aesop asked as he scuttled towards the front door.
No, Grayson said. I live next door. People will recognize me. Let's hit the neighborhood by the school.
Sounds perfect, Aesop hopped in excitement. Though Billy was pretty sure he didn't know why any place was better than any other.
Thankfully, the blue ones were all out for the night, so sneaking Junior and Aesop out wasn't any trouble.
It wasn't until they were halfway across the front lawn, headed for the car, that Billy realized they were walking right under the security cameras. Belphegan teleporting into the house wasn't very stealthy if they just strolled Aesop out the front door. They were officially busted. It was only a matter of time.
Might as well enjoy it now, Billy thought.
Hey, Aesop, Ashlia called. Stop skipping. Robots around here don't know how to skip.
Grayson opened his front door and the spider scampered into the back.
Junior froze. I have to sit next to him, he said uneasily. Yeah, Grayson said. Billy can only fit in the front.
I'll sit by you, Aesop, Ashlia crawled in next to the spider. Billy opened the front door and paused. That prickling sensation ran up his neck again, and he shuddered. It was probably just the cold night air, not the black feeling growing in the pit of his stomach. He looked back at the outline of houses against the dark sky. It almost felt like someone was watching him.
That was ridiculous. He was probably still thinking about the security cameras.
The drive to the school took less than 10 minutes. Billy began feeling more uneasy than ever as soon as they climbed out. The street was narrow, dozens of four-home quadruplexes jammed in as tightly as possible, with barely any grass between the front doors and the road. Billy had no idea where any of the people living there were supposed to park. The scene was lit by orange and purple Halloween lights on almost every front door, and glowing spiders, skeletons, and bats along every path. One house had a giant inflatable Santa in his sleigh out front. Either the owners had missed the memo, or they wanted to get a jump on Christmas. There were a lot of kids walking up and down the street, the parents casually strolling along in the middle of the road chatting. There were too many eyes for this to possibly work.
You're just nervous, he told himself.
We'll just hit a few doors and go.
Billy reached back into the car and pulled out his backpack and his magical demon-smashing baseball bat.
Where he got that from is a long story. He'd learned the hard way to never go anywhere without it.
Did you hear that? Aesop asked as soon as he stepped out of the car.
Hear what?
Billy asked, sliding his arms through the backpack straps. The spider tilted his head, listening. Sounded like someone called my name. A kid strolling past, wearing a wizard school outfit, pointed his wand at Aesop and shouted.
Wow! That's amazing, he said. Dad, look!
The dad didn't look up from his phone as he responded, yeah, that's great.
Aesop waved. I'm a spider robot, he announced.
The kid dropped his hand, his eyes widening, his mouth gaping as they walked past.
Probably shouldn't say anything, Grayson whispered. Kind of obvious you're not a robot when you talk.
Okay, sorry, Aesop giggled. I'm just so excited. I'm ready to trick-or-treat. He danced as he said the words. Grayson popped the trunk of the car and pulled out two orange plastic pumpkins with black eyes painted on them. He handed one to Junior and one to Aesop. The spider held it up with both front claws, admiring it. It's perfect, Grayson, thank you. He gripped the pumpkin in a tight hug and seemed to explode into a jump of excitement. Let's go. Should we go to this one? The house was the first in a quadruplex, orange lights wrapped around the pillar next to the door. About 30 real pumpkins sat on the porch, spilling over onto a small patch of grass next to it.
Ready?
Junior asked. Aesop nodded vigorously. Oh boy, am I. Ashlia, Billy, and Grayson stopped halfway up the path as Aesop and Junior the spider trainer marched the rest of the way and knocked on the door. Grayson held out the remote so it was obvious he was controlling the spider. Trick or treat, Junior announced, holding up his plastic pumpkin. An old lady opened the door, smiling broadly with round cheeks as she admired Junior in his hat.
Oh, little Indiana Jones, she said.
I'm a spider trainer, Junior announced.
The lady looked down at Aesop and took a startled step backwards, a hand over her chest.
"Oh, my, he gave me a fright," she said, laughing lightly. But Billy could see her expression. The street was dark enough to get away with a demon spider, but Aesop was pretty horrifying when you saw him up close in the light on a porch.
"It's my robot. My friend is controlling him," Junior pointed to Grayson, who waved.
"That's incredibly realistic." She dropped a candy bar in Junior and Aesop's pumpkins. "Frighteningly so." She stepped into the house and slammed the door. Junior walked back, a dubious look on his face. Aesop, however, had a skip in his step. "That was great," he said. "I just held up the pumpkin, and she put the candy into it." He pulled the bucket close and peered into it. "Nobody has ever given me anything for nothing. This is the best night of my life. Where to next?"
"Aesop," Junior said, "I don't think that lady was fooled. I'm not sure it's a good idea to try again."
"Oh," Aesop looked up at them all, his eyes big and round. "Really? Please don't make me go back to the apartment. Not yet."
"Bah," said Grayson. "It's totally cool. Nobody anticipates a genuine demon spider. They'll just think you're a sophisticated robot."
"I'm really not sure about that, Gray," Ashleigh said. "There it is again," Aesop said. I think someone's calling me."
"I hope not," Grayson said. "That would be weird."
"Down there." Aesop jumped up and snatched the remote from Grayson. "I'm in control now," he laughed as he ran down the path between the buildings. "Aesop," Billy called. "Not that way."
"You're losing control of your robot." Ashleigh tapped Grayson's arm with the back of her hand.
"Aesop,"
Grayson yelled, following the small demon. They were gone for a whole minute, the worry in Billy's gut growing as the seconds passed. If he had to give a direction to the terrible sensation he was feeling, it was behind the building. Ashleigh folded her arms and started tapping her foot. "What's taking him so long?" She looked at her watch. "Ugh!" She ran down the path into the shadows. That's when she screamed. Junior and Billy looked at each other, then rushed after Ashleigh. The space between the quadruplexes wasn't very big. A strip of grass, maybe 20 feet wide, reaching from the back of one group of houses to the next. Any view to the street from here was completely cut off. The space was dark, the orange and purple Halloween decorations lining the surrounding streets dimly illuminating the scene before them. A huge, demonic spider, perhaps 13 feet tall, stood over Grayson's unconscious body. In his thick, hairy foreleg, he held Ashleigh against his thorax, his arm jammed between her mouth. She held his leg in both hands, supporting her weight as her feet kicked furiously in the air. She looked ticked. The source of the black sensation Billy had been feeling all night suddenly seemed so obvious. There was something dark emanating from this spider, some kind of magic which soaked the air around him and turned Billy's stomach. Aesop stood to the side, his forelegs up over his head, the remote control in one of his trembling claws, the pumpkin in the other.
"You okay?" Billy asked,
drawing his weapon from his backpack. Aesop shook his head. "This is my brother Volker," he peeped.
"What are you doing here?" Billy asked.
Volker grinned, showing an alien mouth lined with fine, knife-like teeth.
"Same as my brother. Stranded after the invasion, though it seems we have different standards on the quality of company we keep." "Why are you here? Now," Billy insisted. "Tonight is a rare gift," Volker growled. "So many helpless meals wandering about. I thought to feast when I noticed my pathetic little brother driving with some humans." "Let our friend go," Billy said. "Friend?" Volker's dozen red eyes narrowed. "Aesop, why do you consort with humans?"
Aesop swallowed.
"Are you planning to kill them?"
Aesop didn't answer.
"Are you going to lure them back to the demonic realm as a treat for our father?"
Aesop looked away.
"Are they your friends?" Volker asked, his voice mocking.
Aesop cowered onto the grass.
"No,"
Volker asked.
"In that case, you won't mind if I kill every one of them in front of you. I plan to feast on human children, but this chubby adolescent will make a complete meal on his own."
Billy knew things were about to hit the fan, but when they did, he had no idea how fast it would happen. Volker kicked Grayson's unconscious body, and it zipped bonelessly through the air. Billy ducked out of the way, but Junior wasn't fast enough. Grayson crashed into him, and they both spilled onto the ground in a tangle of limbs. Billy straightened, just as Ashleigh slammed into him, hard, tossed by Volker. Billy's feet lifted off the grass as Ashleigh connected with his face. She screamed in pain as something snapped and he whumped onto his back. Ashleigh rolled off of him, whimpering. She never complained, and Billy knew she must have been hurt. A fiery rage began boiling up inside him. Nobody hurts my friends. Billy began to rise, but Volker was suddenly above him, the 5-inch-long claw on his front leg extending towards Billy's throat.
There is something different about you, Volker said, sniffing, his breath hot and stale. There is magic in your blood.
Billy felt around the grass for his magical bat, but it had been knocked out of his hand. His head spun from being whacked with his friend. He couldn't hear Grayson or Junior. Ashleigh wheezed in pain, but she was struggling to stand and in no condition to help.
You smell delectable. Volker licked his lips with a thin, slime-covered tongue.
His mandibles rasped together, brushing Billy's face. Billy pushed away, but his hand slipped on the damp grass. His neck throbbed from the whiplash. It was getting harder to think. He had to stand up. He had to put up some fight. This is a stupid way to go. Hey, Aesop shouted from behind Volker. Volker turned. Billy could see the little spider standing on shaking legs, tears in his 8 eyes as he lifted his head. They aren't my friends, Aesop said. They're my family. Volker let out a loud, mocking laugh, which cut off as Aesop rushed forward and bit his hind leg. Volker howled in pain and began turning in circles, shaking his body to toss Aesop off. Aesop gripped his big brother's limb with all of his, digging his claws in as Volker bucked like a bronco. Billy scrambled off the ground. He glanced around, trying to see where his magical bat had gone to, but he couldn't make it out in the dark light. Volker stumbled over to the building and began throwing Aesop into the wall. Aesop squealed in pain, but held on. Volker began slamming him harder, the whole building shaking. He's going to kill him, Ashleigh gasped. Volker rammed Aesop into the wall, the windows of the houses shattering, and the 3-foot-tall spider dropped to the ground, his legs twitching. Even in the darkness, Billy could see the shine from his blood running through the hair on the back of his head as Aesop stumbled, somehow still clutching the remote control and his pumpkin to his chest. Volker stood over Aesop and snarled at him. Billy ran up to Volker and punched him as hard as he could in the jaw. Volker stumbled a step and blinked. He looked at Billy with confusion.
Did you just punch me?
I'll do it again, Billy shouted. Billy held up his fists. He'd been learning about fighting, but he wasn't really good at hand-to-hand combat. Or hand-to-claw? Volker lifted his leg to strike, and Billy stepped in with an uppercut. The huge spider staggered back, shaking his head from the blow.
You're strong, Volker said. Killing you will be satisfying.
You're a bully, Aesop cried, his voice quaking. Aesop, Billy called. Get back. Volker backhanded Billy with his thick leg. He slammed onto the grass, pain shooting up his spine. Billy had fought a lot of demons, but this one was fast for a spider. The magic Billy smelled coming from Volker must have given him some kind of supernatural speed. Billy huffed, his chest throbbing. It was lucky they had stumbled onto Volker before he had a chance to feast on the trick-or-treaters. But that wasn't going to make much difference if he didn't get up off his ass. You're a bully, Volker, Aesop shouted up at his big brother. The spider towered over him, stepping forward slowly, a terrifying shadow in the dark. You are a horrible demon!
No, Volker said. I'm a great demon. You simply have a perverted idea of what a demon should be.
Trick or treat, Aesop said.
What?
Volker tilted his head, confused. Trick or treat, Aesop repeated. You get to choose one.
Oh, is this what those humans on the street are saying? In that case, I choose treat.
He leaned in close to Aesop, his jaws opening wide. Then happy Halloween, Aesop shouted. He sprung forward, the remote controller and pumpkin in his claws, and with a quick 1-2 jammed them both into his big brother's mouth and deep down his throat. Volker stumbled backwards, blinking in surprise. He opened and closed his mouth soundlessly, throwing his head up in an attempt to swallow. He began clawing at his neck as a hissing sound escaped from between his mandibles. Letting out several wet coughs, it looked like he was trying to swallow with his mouth open. Volker began to thrash. The cough became a gagging, choking sound. His neck convulsed in an attempt to gasp, but he couldn't. The desperation began to grow in Volker's eyes as he searched for something to dislodge the objects from his throat. Turning in circles, he slammed a foreleg into his chest, the sound echoing from the houses like a muffled drum. He began raking his claws down his chin and neck, parting his flesh as he tried to dig out the items lodged in his windpipe. Black demon blood sprouted from his skin, spraying the walls around him with an oily liquid.
With the last moment of energy left, he turned to Aesop and lunged. Billy clambered, trying to gain his feet, but his legs and arms still weren't working. Something shot past his vision, and he turned to see Grayson and Ashleigh sprinting forward, hitting Volker in the side with their relatively trivial weights. It was just enough. Volker fell sideways, his claw cutting into the grass inches beside Aesop's head, while the little demon cowered with both forearms covering his eyes. The giant demon spider let out a wet, gurgling sound and went limp. "Wow," someone said. Billy spun around to see a gaggle of trick-or-treaters walking down the path between the houses. "That's huge!" A kid tugged on her friend's sleeve and pointed to Volker's dead body. Black blood still leaking from the cuts in his neck, his glassy eyes staring in the direction of the children. "Really realistic," she replied. "It would look cooler if it moved," another kid, his mouth full of candy, said. "I saw a better one last year." A parent, walking with the kids, shot a perfunctory smile at Billy and said, "Happy Halloween," without actually making eye contact. When the group had left, Grayson crawled over to Aesop, putting a hand on the spider's cheek. "I'm sorry," Grayson said. "This wasn't a good idea." "I had so much fun up until the last bit." A small smile flickered over his face. "Thank you, but I don't think you're getting your remote back." "What do you say we get you back home?" Ashleigh said, cradling her arm.
"You okay?" Billy asked.
"Just dislocated," she shrugged with one shoulder. "I relocated it." Junior limped over to the group. He looked up at Volker, then down at Aesop.
"What did I miss?"
Aesop gave a hideous, but somehow endearing smile, his mandibles curling up beside his grotesque mouth. The worst Halloween treat ever.
The Ghost of the Clipper Bullion Mine by Lauren Mitchell Lambert. Read to you by Richard Wilson. Long ago, when the West was still wild and wicked, when gold still glittered, untouched upon its hills and was washed in its streams, when the life of a man was like a candle in the wind, there sprang up in such a place the Clipper Bullion Mine, and a vibrant little boomtown called Shoop, Idaho, both cradled in a rugged, narrow valley upon the banks of the South Fork of the River of No Return. Back then, one stormy, cold evening in a squalid bar, a group of mud-caked miners sat around a small, rickety table, mechanically shuffling cards and spitting tobacco on the pine-planked floors. With the ebb and flow of Lady Luck, they exchanged small leather pouches of gold dust and stacks of silver coins. One sagacious old miner, hat almost covering his darting green eyes, sat placidly, leaning in his chair against the wall. Suddenly, like a striking rattlesnake, the green-eyed miner seized a pair of dirty hands outstretched to collect the pot. He then spoke softly. "You don't think we knows it, does ya? I's been eyeing ye after last week, and you don't play like we do, ye card-trickin' scum." The accused miner, a spry, ratty-faced man, slowly drew his hands away and whined. "Come on, y'all know them's honest pickings." A metallic click silenced the room as the green-eyed miner pointed his cocked six-shooter at the cheat and demanded that he take his hat off. Every eye watched. The cheat slowly moved his hand toward his hat. Then, in a flash of amazing celerity and cunning, he reached behind his neck and hurled a dagger at the gunman's heart. In the same instant, the gun roared, but too late, its wielder slumped forward. The cheat, clutching the bloodied hole where his left ear had been, drew his own revolver. "Don't any fool follow me," he barked in pain, as he bolted through the door and out into the night. Moments later, the ragged group left their dead companion and trampled out over the cheat's gray hat and the sanguinolent black ace of spades that had fallen from it. After scattering the horses, the cheat tore up the muddy road. Instead of continuing on to freedom, he turned to retrieve a treasure that he had carefully hoarded. He would again gamble with his life in pursuit of the riches that ate at his heart. Here he crossed the river in a small cart that wheeled along on a steel cable high above the cold waters. Hastily, he secured it on the opposite bank. Thunder and lightning betrayed his flight and deafened his ears to the shouts when they spied him across the river. Obliviously, he moved like a deer up the steep mountain shoulder, driven by an insatiable greed and the fear of death in hopes of saving his wretched life and the means to dress up its depravity with the brightness of the world. Wheezing, he passed through the threshold of a small supply shack where he had worked as a miner. He stooped and clawed at the dirt where his booty lay. Seizing it, he darted out the door. Again, the molten bolts of the storm betrayed his position in frozen snapshots to the swarm of pursuers coming up after him. Frantically, he sidestepped to the east and bounded down into a hidden ravine as the wind with mounting fury howled and caused the tall thorny bushes to dance madly and tear at the cheat's face and hands. Then, hoping to escape, he slipped into the mouth of a mine shaft that connected to a backway. Thinking he had evaded the search, the yell, "There he goes, boys! Come on, he's in number 6!" sounded in his ears. The voice cut like a knife at his final bit of hope. With the desperation of a cornered beast, the cheat hastened to make the backway. But as the air grew lighter near the opening, he heard voices. Pausing, pressing his back against the hard wall, he panicked, engulfed in the cold blackness of the mine. Doom and death hung over him. He slunk back into the black interior, groveling, feeling his way to a newly excavated branch of the mine. Here he would wait. First, the cheat reached for his gun to discover an empty holster. Trembling in a cold sweat, he groped upon the floor for something he could strike out with. The voices the cheat had heard were silent. Two miners that had been sent to block off the back way had heard the cheat's retreat back into the mine, and now crept furtively forward while others blocked off the entrance. They had been present when the cheat's gun had been found on the floor of the supply shack, and therefore moved steadily forward. For a fleeting moment, the two heard a rasp, then saw the flicker of a small flame that leaped onto a hazy, sizzling fuse. They bolted backwards as a bundle of dynamite was flung from the cheat's holdout. On its trajectory out into the main tunnel, the bundle struck a wooden strut, then rebounded back towards the cheat. Boom! The escaping two received splinters and rocks in their backs, and the resulting concussion knocked them to their faces as an avalanche of rocks fell down behind them. The others attended the two injured miners. During their efforts, from the other side of the rock barricade came the moan, "You'll never take it from me! You'll never take it!" Days later, the miners began to clear the debris, to remove the body, and to mine the rich gold vein the arterial shaft contained. Hardly commencing, the mountain sent forth a new avalanche of rocks, crushing one of the miners. When the rocks had stabilized, they removed the recent victim from the precarious area. Once again, but fainter, they heard, "You'll never take it from me. Never." "He still lives," they quaked, scurrying out of the mine, fearing to be near when the cheat finally died. They held the superstition that if the cheat died when they were near, his spirit would haunt them on its way to hell. Several weeks later, the mining boss ordered the miners to resume work in the shaft. Time after time, they attempted to open the passage to the precious vein of gold, risking their lives in the shaft they now christened the Death Shaft. To add to their dismay, mysterious accidents arose. Lights malfunctioned, mine carts rolled onto unaware miners, and accidents to miners were frequent. Some even claimed feeling or seeing an apparition in the mine. It was even rumored that, on stormy nights, the ghost of the cheat haunted all the area he had traveled on the night of his death. Consequently, no miner would work the Death Shaft, no matter how much pay he was offered, or no matter how costly the threat. So the mine was abandoned. Not long thereafter, the area's silver and gold-bearing ore was spent. The town and its mine were deserted and left to rot in the hot summer winds and in the bitter winters. And so it remained when the only man who lived in Shoop with his wife told me this tale and claimed that on stormy nights, he too had seen and felt the presence of an evil, discontented spirit. But the story does not end here. Eager for adventure, I asked the old man where the Death Shaft was located, and, disregarding the tale, I set out one evening with Kirk to follow the directions the old man had given me. We crossed the river in our kayaks, ferrying toward the dilapidated cabins and building on the far bank. Leaving our boats on the bank, we explored the old buildings. The most interesting building housed a huge motor that had driven a thick steel cable upon which the ore had been conveyed down the upper mines, much in the same manner that today's ski chairlifts operate. We started up the mountain following the rusty cables. They led up a rocky ridge that was flanked by a dense forest of pine and aspen trees, and was crowded with ferns and berry bushes. We hiked for 30 minutes before diverging to the east to follow a wide terrace, which must have been a road for mine carts. At its end, a path led up a dell where a small shack stood. I hurried to inspect it while Kirk explored elsewhere. The one-roomed shack with cloudy but unbroken glass panes, cupboards, and a table all still intact stood as a lonely, silent sentinel. There was nothing immediately unusual about the old shack, but oddly, no cobwebs, debris, or dirt encumbered its interior, as if someone lived there, yet with a clean that felt cold and sterile. My first thought was that some old hermit was living in it, and so, feeling uncomfortable, I searched for foodstuffs or articles of clothing, but found nothing. "Intruder, leave this place," came a soundless whisper to my mind. I left. Out the door, I faced the sky. The setting sun sent dying shafts of light through the pine boughs. Suddenly, an uncontrollable shudder shook me. I felt someone watching from behind and thought that Kirk had snuck up to give me a scare, so I pivoted about. No one was there. Again facing the west, I saw Kirk starting up towards the shack. "Come check this out, Kirk," I called. To the northeast of the shack was a path. There were no footprints marking its surface, but no grass or weeds were encroaching upon it either. I struck out to follow it as Kirk passed by me into the shack. The path gradually descended, then dropped into a narrow box-shaped ravine. At its back was the entrance to a mine shaft, revealed by the slag slope pushed out over the base of the ravine. I trotted to the entrance and called for Kirk to join me. As I sat inspecting a minecart upon metal rails just inside the mine, Kirk arrived. "You shouldn't have yelled," whispered Kirk. "Some old hermit's around, I just know it. I had the most awful feeling back there." "Look at this cart, Kirk. There's not a thing wrong with it, and the shovel looks like it hasn't been disturbed since the last miner placed it there 80 years ago, as though it's waiting to be picked up by the same hands. Come on, let's take a look inside," I said. Flashlight in hand, I stole into the dark interior. Kirk reluctantly followed, throwing a searching glance over his shoulder before entering. Light-footed, we came upon thick wooden support beams that were decaying in the moist interior. Our light revealed fat, luminescent eyes coming at us from the dark spaces in the wood. I stepped back as a fat pack rat scuttled over my left foot. Cringing, we leaped past the spot. Rails from the main shaft ran into it, but stopped abruptly under a mound of rocks and splintered timbers which blocked a once deeper shaft. Upon further investigation, the flashlight I held grew dim, then hot. I dropped it. Blackness surrounded us. "Not funny," whispered Kirk. I assured him I was not joking. At that moment, the sound of footsteps reverberated from all directions. They came loud and fast. We concertedly stumbled towards the distant light of the entrance. The air seemed to grow hot and nefarious, choking us. Pushing through the almost overpowering thickness, we jumped past the fat sentinels and the rotted beams, the echoing footsteps chasing us from behind. At the entrance, an unnerving shower of dirt and pebbles fell from somewhere above the mine. We hesitated in the half-light of dusk, fearing what lay behind and not daring to discover what had disturbed the earth above the entrance of the mine. "Let's get out of here," I urged. Kirk stealthily surveyed the area above us. Seeing nothing, we darted out and down the slag slope, down the rocky ridge, down through thorns that ripped our pants and tore our skin. We did not stop until we were across the river. I looked up into the darkness. Something I felt but could not see was watching. The experience grew old with the evening. In camp, we disbelieved ourselves as we shared our tale with others. We were able to rationally explain each phenomenon. A hermit had recently lived there, the flashlight had malfunctioned, dripping water sounded like footsteps, and a startled deer had unsettled the slide at the mine's entrance. Whatever the cause, it evoked the spirit of adventure in all of the others, and a return trip was scheduled for the following week. On that day, we again headed for the Clipper Bullion Mine. This time, we all loaded into the camp raft just up the river and floated it into a back eddy at the mine. Being true guides, Kirk and I took the other 4 river guides and 2 girl cooks through the old buildings. We climbed the ridge, making considerable racket, enough to drive any solitary-loving hermit deeper into the seclusion of the woods. Making poor time, we finally came to the lonely shack, and after combing the area, our curiosity was spent. The shack and mine shaft were as we left them a week ago. Nothing unusual happened. My friends all started back down the slope. Darkness again flew gently down from the east. Standing at the mine's entrance, I lingered, pondering the past weekend. I turned to meticulously inspect the minecart that stood silent upon rusty rails. Both the cart and the shovel inside had remained untouched. Turning to leave, I noticed at my feet a small rectangular object. I stooped and plucked it from the ground. Hot, stifling air blew at my back. Unconsciously drawn, I glanced back into the mine's black orifice. From deep within its darkness, I could see an amorphous specter of twisting light as it came rapidly looming towards me. Overcoming my spellbound stare, I stuffed the object into my shirt pocket and ran down the mountain. I almost flew down that hill, and after several falls, I caught my boisterous companions. Then, my face still pale, I drew from my pocket the object I had found. Uncontrollably shuddering, I looked down at a black ace of spades stained with fresh blood. Still transfixed, I watched as the card faded, turned brown, then crumbled in my hands, as a sultry gust blasted the disintegrating pieces from me. Then a voice from far away, yet as clear as the purl of the river, sounded. "You'll never take it from me! Never take it from me!" Chilled to the bone, I looked up into the darkling tree line and could feel something watching.
The Full Moon Festival, written by Brianna Bedore, read by Liam Neary, October 31st, 2209 CE, Luna Terra, Nearside, Northern Prefecture. Now arriving at Orbit Gate 64B, Aristotle Station, the announcement hummed pleasantly over the shuttle's intercom. If this is your stop, please prepare to disembark. Finally, Jude stood and stretched, making a pretense to help the others get their bags down from the overhead compartments. They didn't make shuttles for people Jude's height, but complaining about it wasn't going to give him any extra legroom. Declan stood too, peering past Jude to the other passengers quickly clogging the walkway.
I told them to seat us closer to the exit, Declan huffed. What if we can't exit and we miss the limo pickup to the station?
I told them that I... Oh, hush, Deck, Eliza said blandly, fanning herself with her hat. The moon doesn't revolve around you.
I'm so glad you're along to remind me that I don't matter.
Thank you for the support, Liza, Declan shot back. Jude raised an eyebrow and drew his mouth into a line, but didn't chime in. The two of them had been at it the entire shuttle ride from Tycho, and he had no interest in getting in the crosshairs of their bickering. Eliza and Declan had a pretty messed-up breakup about a month back, but they'd been planning this trip for so long, it's not like they could just cancel their plans. The Full Moon Festival was supposed to be the most spectacular event in the entire Sol System, and Declan had free tickets. So, they stuck to their original plan. Declan, Jude, and his oldest friend, Eliza, his ex, and Eliza's little sister Mia just had to make it through a few days in close proximity. No big deal. They were all mature adults, right? Apparently not. They'd only just arrived in Aristotle's, and Jude wasn't looking forward to the festival anymore. He was just hoping Declan and Eliza didn't kill each other before the end of the night. As he pulled another bag down, he caught Mia's eyes as she gathered her things together. She glanced towards Deck and Liza, then looked back at Jude with a lopsided grin, almost as if to say, "Can you believe these two?" Jude blinked, sort of grinning back at her, and refocused on the luggage. Was he nervous? Why would he be nervous? He hadn't met Mia before this trip, but that was no reason to feel off kilter. After a healthy amount of jostling, they squeezed out of the crowded shuttle car and into the greater chaos of the orbit gate. Shuttles rocketed in and out, launching from their sloped channels to swing into the dark atmosphere as the announcements crackled in a dozen different languages, and travelers moved like tangled streams towards various platforms. Projections of dark clouds sailed along the walls everywhere Jude looked, like a digitalized earth and sky. Occasionally, a golden light would emerge from the clouds, a full harvest moon, with the festival's logo on it. The clouds would push over the moon again, and the logo would reemerge on another wall.
This way, Declan called out to the group over his shoulder. Keep up!
Jude juggled his unwieldy costume bag, his hat box, Declan's hat box, and a few other bags, nearly smacking a bystander as he readjusted a strap. Slow down, Eliza begged, drowning under her ridiculously overpacked pile of costuming provisions. A long garment bag slid off her shoulder and slumped onto the ground. Jude doubled up his bags on one shoulder, reaching out to her, but Mia swooped in just ahead of him, silently picking up the dropped bag and relieving her sister of a few others. They made their way clumsily to the exit, guided the whole way by Declan, marching ahead like an anxious drum major, where their limo driver, an actual human, surprisingly, not a self-driven chauffeur car, picked them up. Declan wasted no time explaining to his captive strangers why he was so important.
I programmed the light fixtures for this festival, he told the hapless driver. Every little holographic flame was my handiwork. Everything from the tiniest candle flames in the chandeliers to the growing grins of each smirking jack-o'-lantern. Atmosphere is everything, and Eliza cut in, leaning forward.
Why don't you ask him why he couldn't just use actual candles instead of hiring this chucklehead? She said to the driver. Declan wheeled back towards Eliza.
An open flame in an oxidized kratom? Pah! He shook his head. You'd have to be a moron, or asking for a catastrophe. One bad spark and the whole thing could go up in flames. Whoosh!
He snapped his fingers to continue his monologue, ignoring his ex-girlfriend's veiled jab. The driver deposited them at their hotel with a weary sounding, "Enjoy your stay." And Declan gave the orders to meet back at the lobby at 1700, dressed and ready for their night of magic. Jude opened up his pocket watch for the umpteenth time. 1713. His watch had to be incorrect. He shouldn't trust a gear-based timepiece, even if he had set it and wound it himself. He felt like a fool, standing by himself in the lobby, dressed up in his festival regalia, despite the fact that everyone else was dressed up too. Maybe it was because the top hat made him look taller than he already was. He took it off and held it awkwardly in his gloved hands. Everyone looked like they had stepped out of an old earth painting. The men wore long, dark overcoats, often made of thick velvet with impossible amounts of embellishment, complete with lace cuffs and collars. The women wore bustled dresses in deep jeweled tones, or short, ruffled flounces with layers upon layers of gathered fabric. The festival outlined an aesthetic dress code, but the interpretation was left to the individual guests. As a result, there was a uniformity of decadence and intrigue, as if everyone had a wealth of secrets tucked up their satin gloves or tightly laced against their chest. Jude wondered if he was wearing his pocket watch correctly. Did it go with his waistcoat, or... Tucking his hat under one arm, he took out the watch and checked it again, for good measure. "Jude!" Mia called out, jogging to join him. Her ruffle skirt swirled around her knees, and her lace veil fluttered away from her face as she moved. "Sorry Liza's late. I tried to make her hurry," she said, puffing a little. "Declan's the only one who would mind," Jude said, smiling down at her. "And he's just as late." Mia tilted her head to one side. "He speaks! And he has a nice voice, too," she said playfully. "You're a quiet guy, aren't you?"
I don't mean to be."
Jude clicked his pocket watch open and shut again, smile fading. "I'm in my head a lot. Work habit."
"What do you do?"
"I work with Declan. Theoretical machine learning. He's on the implementation side of things. And I..."
He stuffed the timepiece back into his overcoat pocket. "Theorize." Mia shrugged.
"I think people talk too much in general. Take dear old Declan and my sister, for example. Not everything needs to be said."
"Fair." Jude huffed out a quiet laugh, shuffling his top hat from one hand to the other. "But it's worth saying that your dress is lovely."
She lit up, smiling at him, her red lips standing out behind the dark lace of her veil.
"Thanks. I like your hat."
I don't know if it works for me," he gestured helplessly at himself.
She held out her hands.
"May I?"
Jude passed the silk top hat without a word. She looked it over, seemed to choose the side, then reached up on her tiptoes to place it atop his head.
"There,"
she said, satisfied with the placement. "Very dashing." He grinned back at her. He took a deep breath. Maybe this trip wasn't going to be such a wash after all.
"Say,"
small talk bubbling out of him unexpectedly, "do you know much about what Hallow's Eve was like on old Earth?"
"Not really."
"It used to be a holiday of understanding the past and looking forward to the future. Communicating with the dead, reading fortunes, that kind of thing," he told her.
"Huh."
Mia fixed an errant ruffle on her dress.
"And I thought it was about dressing up as monsters and feeding your kids so much candy that they got sick and stopped asking for sugar all the time."
She looked back at him with a wicked expression, but Jude couldn't return it. Eliza and Declan arrived.
"Here they come,"
Jude whispered to Mia.
"Showtime,"
she said back to him.
"Smiles on, everybody."
The former couple arrived on different elevators, almost simultaneously, both of them dressed as though they were trying to outdo the other. Though, somehow, they only managed to look more like a couple than ever, as if they were the only two survivors in the fallout of the gothpocalypse, languishing under the weight of their unwanted ruffs and their deformed growths of gaudy jewelry. They glanced at each other, and both of their expressions darkened.
"Liza,"
Mia called out to her sister.
"You look like a queen."
Eliza stuck her nose in the air, partially. Jude suspected, so that she could keep her gaze away from Declan. She took Mia's arm and the two stepped into the flow of the festival's goers and headed toward the hotel tram.
"Is my chapeau all right?" Declan asked, nudging Jude.
"Your what?"
He gestured to the ruffled tie thing at his neck, fastened in place by a huge ruby brooch. Jude made a show of fiddling with some of the lace, remembering how much he'd felt about his hat after Mia fixed it.
"You look great, man," he said. "Dashing, even."
Declan nodded gratefully, picked up his walking stick, and stomped off to lead the pack again. The subterranean trams brought them right to the Full Moon's Festival insulated crater dome. Rather than the usual bubble shape of Luna Terra's settlements, the festival's dome was made to look like a big-top circus, crowned with pennant flags at the point of its draping frame. None of them said a word as they approached the entryway. Rather than doors, there were dozens of tall, bare-branch artificial trees made out of pure light.
and as they brushed past them into the festival, they entered a completely new world. Within the dome was an entire city, crafted like a love letter to the old world storybooks. The kind of storybooks that frightened as much as they delighted. The architecture was angular and dark, with tall towers and chimneys, wide windows and thick panes, and cobblestone steps into deep doorways. The streets were lined with wrought iron streetlights, each hung with garlands of dark roses flickering with faux gas flames. Jack-o'-lanterns of all shapes and sizes lined the stoops or grimaced in windows, and gargoyles patrolled the flying buttresses of the tallest, most intricate buildings. Jude was astounded by the craftsmanship and even the slightest detail. There was a damp chill in the air, like the promise of rain on an earthing evening. And just at the edges of his hearing, he could pick up a faint melody of a music box being played somewhere. Looking up from inside, the tent was translucent enough to see the faint stars in the glittering rings of the orbital highway, its magnetic particles arcing along the dark skies like comet tails. The ground below their feet glowed with a faintly golden light, as an Earth child might imagine there would be, standing on the surface of a full moon. Mia pulled her sister ahead and twirled her over the golden sands. Liza's long train kicked up little particles, throwing shining motes into the air. Each little grain glowed of its own volition, and they drifted back down to the ground like waltzing fireflies. Jude watched, wondering how they achieved the effect. Was it a projection, like Declan's holographic designs? He crouched down to touch the sand. It was real. Maybe a phosphorescent compound? He looked up to ask Declan, who was staring at the splendor, slack-jawed. This is unbelievable, Declan said to himself. I spent ages coding the right interplay of yellow and orange, with the subtle flashes of blue and white to get the exact nuance of flame. I wrote all of those algorithms that made them act independently, fluttering when someone walked by. His voice got louder as he went on. The colors complement the atmosphere exactly, and their glowing floor is upstaging my work. That wasn't the reaction Jude was expecting. He furrowed his brow and straightened. Chemistry is for barbarians, Declan continued. Holographic design is the true core of lunar innovation.
You do great work, Deck, Jude reassured him. It's not easy to get the hologram to throw organic light, let alone respond to its environment. They probably couldn't manage such a feat with the flooring.
Liza just never understood my work, you know? Declan sighed, speaking so only Jude could hear. Typical for her to be more enthralled by a moonlit floor. It's completely frivolous and unrealistic anyway. Eliza let go of her spinning sister. My ringlets are a mess now, she said, pulling out a hand mirror to assess her damage. So what should we go see first? Mia asked the group at large, gesturing to the ubiquitous attraction signs lining the thoroughfare.
I don't care, Declan said, looking up into one of his holographic street lamps.
Maybe whatever has the shortest wait time? Jude offered. Go ahead and scout it out, Eliza said, still staring into her hand mirror. There were so many things to do around them, each with stylish names that didn't tell Jude much about what they actually had to offer. There were signs for Autumn Passage, Midnight Only, Fortune's Fire, The Mythical Menagerie, Symphony of Storms, and The Traitor's Trust. Jude was entirely overwhelmed. There, Mia said, pointing. Symphony of Storms seems easy to get in. It was a little opera house, its marquee lit up with the attraction title. A stream of people poured out as another crowd filtered in. Jude followed Mia up towards the entrance. Mia looked over her shoulder. Liza and Declan aren't following us, she said. They hadn't noticed Jude and Mia leave. They were both ignoring everything in an attempt to ignore each other. Mia turned all the way around, walking backwards, and called out to them. Hey, you guys! She wasn't watching where she was going. The exiting crowd engulfed her, the chattering festival-goers making a wedge between Jude and Mia, pulling her away from him. Jude reached out and took her hand, using his size to make the people move for him, and brought her back in close. Careful, he said, letting go of her hand. Mia laughed. I'm paying attention, she said. Mostly.
I'm sure you are, Jude replied. It's everyone else I'm worried about.
They found a place in line. Declan and Eliza were able to cut in with them just as they reached the entrance, and together they filed inside. The auditorium was one open mezzanine, a huge balcony that circled a central, sunken stage. Other audience members filtered in and out, taking their seats or leaving, as whatever they were watching below seemed to go on indefinitely. Jude and the others reached the railing and peeked down at the stage. The show was a massive thunderhead, surging and shifting into abstract shapes and tableaus, faces, creatures, and spawning structures. Everything was lit by veins of lightning, and the caged wind would slip free and hit the audience with sprays of rain. At one end of the theater, a man in a tailcoat sat at a gigantic apparatus, almost like an old earth organ. Rows and rows of keys, levers, dials, and pedals all fed into this enormous array of pipes. Clouds and winds poured out of these pipes as he worked the innumerable keys, orchestrating the entire storm himself. The group shuffled into a row of open seats, but Jude managed to settle directly in front of the short, older gentleman, who would never have been able to see. He leaned over to Declan, whispering, "Can you switch with me?" "Ah, right." They switched as a boom of thunder shook the auditorium. The audience clapped appreciatively, the sound polite and muffled with their gloved hands. Eliza shrunk back in her chair as a spray of water swept up towards them, whimpering about her dress. "Would you like to switch?" Jude offered. "I can block some of the water." She shook her head, flipping open her fan to hide behind it. "You're missing it," Mia hissed at her, sitting at the edge of her seat. "Just switch." They shuffled again, Eliza half hid behind Jude's shoulder, ducking down whenever a big swell approached. Mia watched with open-faced wonder, captivated with every crack of lightning and rumble of thunder as the clouds boiled over each other. Jude couldn't help but be caught up by her, and couldn't say how long they had stayed there, enraptured by the unknown, ever-changing story of the storm. When at last they teetered out of the opera house, Declan nudged him with an elbow. "I bet the whole thing was holograms," he said with an air of pride. "To be honest," Jude said, pulling out his handkerchief, "I didn't even think about it." "What about those sprays of water?" He dabbed a few droplets left on his face. "Psh, don't let all that smoke and mirrors fool you," Declan scoffed. "Holograms. And a few well-placed sprinklers." Declan might have been right, but Jude felt an inexplicable resistance to the idea that it was all programmed light and pantomime. The storm, however it was achieved, was incredible. He shrugged it off and replaced his handkerchief as the four of them embarked to the next attraction. The festival caught them up in its whirlwind of wonder. They saw mythological creatures made of iridescent topiary that moved on mechanized armatures to wander about the lunar garden, each leaf a shard of stained glass. There were even phoenixes soaring overhead, and a solitary whale that swam under the surface of the glass garden floor. There was an interactive augmented reality murder mystery, where every individual saw something that convinced them that they were the killer all along. They rode a Ferris wheel made to look like they were riding giant moths, which made Eliza motion sick, and wandered a dark maze lit only by the radiance of the full moon flooring. Deck and Liza had stopped trying to antagonize each other, more or less, but only because they'd come to lean too heavily on Jude and Mia, effectively splitting their group down the middle. Jude frequently found himself looking over the schism of silence between them, trying to catch Mia's reactions to each new wonder. He wanted to ask her what she thought, but time and again found himself bogged down in conversations with Declan about the construction of each attraction. It had never bothered him before, but the deconstruction of the full moon's festivals into a series of hows seemed to deflate the whole experience. By the time they stopped to eat, Jude was feeling agitated, hungry for something that he was missing in all this spectacle. There were countless stalls serving moon-themed delicacies and harvest delights. Pot pies with Lunaterra craters carved into the crust, stacks of crescent-shaped honey cakes, golden curries with earth-imported vegetables, and balls of caramel popcorn studded with chocolate-covered hazelnuts. Nothing really called out to Jude's appetite, but he'd liked popcorn as a kid. With the others queued up at food stalls, Mia found an automaton vendor with a seemingly endless teapot, claiming it would calculate your perfect cup of tea based on your favorite poem. Mia gave it a title from a 22nd century neo-romances, and it poured her a cup of something pinkish. She lifted her veil, took a sip, and burst out laughing. "How is it?" Jude called out to her from his place in line. "Terrible," she replied, sounding absurdly happy about it. "Way too sweet. Not the way I take my tea at all." She took another sip, made a face, and went to bring it to Eliza. "Try this, sis. It's absurd." But Eliza didn't seem to hear. She was entirely caught up in Declan's conversation with a pretty young woman serving apple dumplings. "I designed the flame effects, you know," he said, making a vague, sweeping gesture. "After your shift, I could take you on a little chandelier tour.
Eliza covered her mouth with both hands, then dashed down one of the festival's many alleyways. Liza! Declan called after her. Hey, Liza! He chased after her, leaving his apple dumpling and his wallet with the young lady. Without thinking, Jude took a few steps to follow them, but Mia caught his arm. Let them work it out, she said. If anybody needs to understand the past and reach into the future, it's those two. Jude watched his friend vanish down a side street and suppressed a groan, stepping up to buy his caramel popcorn. For all of Declan's intelligence, he's pretty oblivious. Mia snorted.
Liza, too. She's got a big heart, not that you'd ever know. Say,
she perked up, struck by an idea.
Why don't we ditch them? Go see a few attractions on our own.
She hadn't let go of his arm, and was now pulling on his sleeve. I don't know. Jude struggled to exchange the right coins with the cashier and accept his huge popcorn ball while Mia was tugging on him. What if they need us? Then, from somewhere high in the big top tent, the sound of bells radiated, chiming out the approach of midnight. The bustle of the food court dwindled to a reverent hush, listening to the minor tones of the bells. An ambient voice lilted through the crowd, as if carried by the breeze.
Attention, ghouls and ghosts. Autumn's passage is about to begin. Don't miss the one and only performance. Come on, Jude!
Mia took his hand and began to pull him after her. Her hand was so much smaller than his, and yet it seemed to fit so easily. He trailed along as they winded their way through the crowd. Autumn's passage was nothing more than a huge open wall on one side of the crater dome, a massive window out into the monochrome landscape of the Aristotle's crater. Looking more closely, Jude noticed airlocks positioned at each end of the window. He could barely make out the shadows of what must be a performer preparing inside one of the translucent locks. He and Mia settled into an opening in the throng of people. Now that they weren't going to be separated in the crowd, she let go of his hand and reached up to take a cluster of the caramel popcorn. Can you see all right? He asked.
Yep,
she said, chewing the sticky stuff.
I have a nice window right...
Just then, someone stepped right in front of her, blocking her view entirely. Jude reached out over Mia and nudged the man on one side. Hey, pal, look out for the lady, he said. The man turned, frowning, but his hostile expression wilted when he looked up at Jude.
My apologies,
he muttered, shrinking to one side. Mia's veil was pulled back, and Jude could see her cheeks flushed.
Thanks,
she said softly, blinking with surprise. He just nodded, then cleared his throat. The lights dimmed all around them. Declan's precious holographic flames turned down to mere sparks. It was starting. He wondered, did Mia feel the same unexpected connection that he did? Would she? Jude stopped himself mid-thought. What was he doing? He didn't even know Mia, but he'd abandoned Declan to trapeze around this silly fair and eat popcorn with a pretty girl. He was just spinning away in his own head, getting carried away by the theoreticals. In nonsense. He handed over the popcorn to Mia and folded his arms. The performer emerged from the airlock cloak of mist. The vapor poured out around her, draining away to spill across the ashy surface of Luna Terra. First, the helmet was revealed, an incandescent golden orb like the harvest moon in Earth's sky, like a Byzantine halo. As she stepped forward through the billowing cloud, Jude could see that her dress was made entirely of green leaves, layers and layers of them, carefully arranged into an intricate ball gown that flowed around her. As each leaf was deprived of oxygen, it changed color, and in seconds, the dress blossomed into a sunset of ruby, gold, and russet. And once changed, each leaf peeled itself off and floated out into the low gravity. Layer by layer, they changed colors and fluttered out behind her as she walked, leaving a wake of gold that slowly turned to ash. The final layer shifted, falling away, to reveal underneath a perfectly skin-tight suit of webbing black lines, like the black shadows of barren branches silhouetted against the starry sky. Jude's mind raced. How long had it taken to construct every single synthetic leaf, to design the compounds to make them change color, to compose the patterns so that they would peel off in the right order? All for, what, 20 seconds of decay? He felt like he couldn't take it all in fast enough. It was crumbling before him even now. Something made him look down at Mia, curious to see her reaction. She stood completely transfixed by the passage of autumn, one tear sliding down her cheek. She was beautiful, and funny, and sweet, and so alive. A peaceful quiet settled over Jude. This is what all that work had been for. Something so beautiful, so fragile, so fleeting. It forced them to be present. Shy away, get distracted, overthink it,
and he'd miss it. He'd miss her. Jude reached down and took Mia's hand as the last few leaves drifted down to ash. She interlaced her fingers with his. The spirit of autumn reached the airlock on the other side, leaving nothing more than looming darkness over a trail of footprints and crumbled black leaves. There was nothing else to prove that it happened at all, except that Mia squeezed Jude's hand and leaned against him, and he felt her deep, content sigh.
The Burgle by Candace J. Thomas, read by Kirsten Hallows. The creature cracked its bony knuckles one by one as it examined the dark space under the bed. A few stray socks, a missing toy or two, things the boy never played with. A small wheeze vibrated its pudgy nostrils in musical fashion. The casual drip slipped down the leathery hide, and the Burgle sucked in once more before the boy returned. The Burgle in no way liked the human, sniveling biscuit of a boy, doughy and hard-boiled, with no cleverness or cunning to save him. Even in these dark hours, the boy crisped on munchables near his bed. The tiny bits fell to the ground. It sniffed them. But the salties were no meal and not satisfying the craving. A sharp pain pressed deep inside it. The Burgle had no appetite for forgotten sweeties. The hunger pushed, desperate for the treasure. The point of its ears pricked, hearing the steps coming. It sniffed the dribbling fluid again as the door crept open.
"I did, Mum," the menace of a boy exclaimed. "I brushed 'em all, even the back ones."
Another voice asked something the Burgle could not hear, but the boy responded,
"Promise, Mum, not too late. Good night."
The door closed and a soft light went on. The Burgle squinted out of habit, though the dark under the bed was plenty sufficient for its large pupils. A small shuffling happened when the plump boy made to shrug off his breeches and sling on something looser, as he had done previous nights. The boy hummed to himself. Sometimes a word or two popped from his mouth. The Burgle's ears bent, limited the noise, concentrating on the prize that waited. Soon the bright disappeared, and a dim light lit in a tiny box. The Burgle licked its lips. Little things would go into the boy's ears, and then not soon after, the privileged boy would drift to sleep. Its eyes grew wide in anticipation. Weight hit the bed with a thud, moving and creaking, settling into sunken creases and worn-in wood slats. Little dusties floated down from the boards, particles from years of human mulching. The Burgle's huge eyes blinked away the filth and looked up at the sag where the head would be. The itchy part of its throat gurgled. The Burgle pulled its neck tight and gulped down the growing drool. Juicy, wet hunger started dribbling by its mouth. It found the boy three nights previous and tried to snatch, but the nasty human woke. The taste, so sweet, the craving consumed it. It needed the nasty soul for its own. The sweet possibilities in this boy called to him, a succulent, delicious soul to feed on. It swelled with happiness and even some joy, pure joy. The Burgle wrung his hands at the thought. He relished joy. The clever ones hid their feelings where the Burgle couldn't feast on them, but this one was ripe and knew no better. A stupid fool of a boy, clumsy and selfless, opening sharing feelings with others, no guard, no security, even better, more juicy and sweet. A spider crept on a small wrapper of spongy fruit near the post, ready to slurp the sticky goo. Spiders were fine for crunching, but he had no appetite for them now. Not when the soul of a human boy was so close to his reach. Snotty excitement ran down from its open nostrils. Anticipation ate away. The creature wiped with both hands down the front of its chest, caking the skin with coats of white mucus, preparing for the gentle slaughter. Patience. Oh, the Burgle despised patience. It hungered for instant satisfaction and for fat, juicy boys to fall asleep quickly.
Its hands began to fidget, thinking of all the potential it would steal and savor and suck on for years. Or pure, delicious love, spreading like jam between its fingers. Its stomach clenched tight at every crunching, so desperate. It wiped the drool again. The light from the little box went black, and tiny snores rattled the chest. The little creature snorted and quietly crawled from the side of the bed. Click, clack, with its gnarled, spindly claws up the old wood. It sank in nails, making the scramble easy, delightful, until it grabbed the slippery cloth around the sponge cushion by the boy's head. The plump boy lay untucked from the bedding. Bushy, unkempt hair flopped on the side of the pillow. A soft, spoiling rush to the burgle's head as it saw the plump pink cheeks, the mouth halfway open. The sly greed slipped its mouth. The mattress rolled as the fat human moved his body, spilling one of the ear quieters to the side of the boy's head. The creature pushed against the pillow and kept quiet until the snores came back. Now with the boy on his side, it would be easier to steal. The burgle smacked its bulbous lips, knowing the yum coming. Sweet, crunching, savory soul ready for snatching. The burgle, oh so quietly, slipped behind the pillow to the other side, where the nose and mouth made such a racket. The overgrown mop of hair swung over the boy's eyes, helping hide the burgle's presence. A smug smile covered the creature's greedy little face. The burgle rubbed the front of its chest, gathering its goo on its palms. The little creature licked each one to make it sticky, enjoying the sweet tang before it placed its grubby fingers around the boy's nose and pinched it closed. The burgle's eyes grew wide in anticipation, searching in the air for what it needed, wind blowing hard as the young man's mouth exhaled hard. The strings appeared immediately. It flew forward and it snatched at the light. Its little finger wrapped tight around one and pulled, a clever one, smelled of hope. He loved stealing hope, delicious and swelling with expectations. He quickly reeled it in until the seed popped through the boy's mouth. He spun it expertly into a spool and stuck it in his prepared chest. Greed consumed him. The burgle went back with its pinching fingers and held the huge nostrils closed again. Another puff, and more strings flew out. It snatched two more. One smelled of creativity, the other of friendship. The creature clenched hard with its sticky palms with glee. Too good to be true. Both were succulent and complicated, both a treat, and both started slipping through his fingers. The burgle sneered and tugged harder to keep them, but creativity slipped back down the boy's throat. The burgle took both of his spindly hands and reeled. Friendship was a rare one to appear. Greed flushed its face, its mouth slobbered thinking about it. Hunger controlled it as it took a lick of the string before placing it on its chest. The spicy, citrusy tang tasted better than anything yet devoured. Its fingers nearly slipped with excitement, dancing as it wrapped something so valuable. A massive hand swung up to the boy's nose, nearly swiping the creature. The burgle nearly forgot itself in the overwhelming excitement. It scampered behind the pillow again, waiting for the hand to go back. But it didn't. It rested near the nose. It had too. Delicious. But the greedy burgle couldn't stop thinking about more luscious soul. This boy laid ripe with fresh one. The burgle moved quietly and evaluated the sleeping human. The boy's hand was close to the nose, but not covering it. One more. It just wanted one more. So expertly and quietly, the burgle moved back around the pillow and under the boy's massive arm toward the nose. Slowly its fingers went and grasped the nostrils closed one more time. One more. Yummy. Delicious. The boy squirmed a little looking for breath. One more. Sticky sweetness.
A large exhale, and the creature pounced toward the strings. The graspy fingers splayed wide, wanting anything, anything. Its pupils engorged with desire. More! The boy had so much more. The burgle wanted all of it. Every string, every fiber of soul. Juicy, scrumptious soul. Its hands tightened. Three! It had caught three! The burgle pulled with all its strength down, trying to fling the seeds away from the sucking intake. It couldn't tell what they were. It didn't care. The boy was ripe, full of pleasures, emotions to take and keep. The creature wanted them all. It yanked the strings as hard as it could. It would take anything from this sugary treat. The boy moved quickly, sharply, sending the burgle scrambling near the end of the bed, the strings flying wildly away from its grip. It squeezed harder and reached, losing footing on the mattress, and began to tumble. The burgle grabbed around its belly, protecting the already reeled catch. It was still in reach of a string. The greed consumed every action. One more. The burgle swung around, the seed still heavy in the boy's mouth. The ground came closer, its skeletal wrist wrapped quickly around the floating strings to secure it. One pulled tight while the other slinked back inside as the boy inhaled hard, nearly gasping. Crash! The greedy burgle rolled near the closet, hitting some unused balls and sticks, sending them tumbling to the floor. The boy opened his eyes and shot up in bed, breathing hard. The fat human looked frightened, and his eyes peered over at the random mess on his floor. He wiped his nose and mouth and expelled foul words of disgust before wiping the sticky residue on the bedcloth. The burgle sniffed and scampered back into a dark corner, safe and unseen by the human's eyes, as it reeled the last of the boy's kindness and added it to the beautiful collection. Delicious.
The Creature by Luke Howater. Read by Liz Christensen. I don't remember the first night I saw the creature. In fact, it's possible it had always been there, standing at the foot of my bed in darkness. There was a time before it had taken a shape, a time where I thought I could feel a presence while I stared into the black of night, a presence that somehow crackled like the black and white static of a television with no signal. The crackle was loud in the silence of my bedroom sanctuary. The creature could disappear without a trace, leaving only the thought that it must have been my imagination running away with me, my mind being carried away in the stream of consciousness. The creature wasn't real. I must have invented it. I decided that it was fiction and that false creations couldn't hurt me. I was wrong. I was 14 when the creature began to take a corporeal form. The darkness began to stretch into a thin figure nearly 8 feet tall. The creature had to start hunching over to fit in my bedroom, leaning over my bed. Some nights, my eyes would snap open from my sleep to see the dark figure almost hovering over my head. I would shut my eyes tight and tell myself that I was lost in imagination again. The creature was not real. It could not be real. I was 15 when I saw the creature's eyes for the first time. I awoke from a nightmare, startled and hoping to escape the horror of my dreams in reality, but instead there was the creature. It was leaning in, closer than it had ever been, and I could see the eyes begin to form in the darkness, being willed into existence as I watched. I saw the white of the sclera form in the night, almost hopeful in the bleak animal, but then the thin red veins began to shoot across, covering the pale surface like a spider web. Then, as if rolling forward out of its skull, the iris rolled down the white, killing the hope, with chilling menace as they constricted, focusing in on me. There was no color, just black. Then the pupils seemed to emerge from the black iris, two pupils in each eye. They emerged as if someone punched a hole in a curtain and a light shone through. I could never find comfort in the light of the creature's eyes. It wasn't warm. It was cold, harsh, and distant. It seemed as if the glow itself meant to do me harm. The eyes moved closer to my face, and for the first time my fear overcame my senses, and I cried out. I heard my father quickly shuffle down the hallway as the eyes descended on me. I saw a thin, pale face begin to form around the eyes until the door to my room flew open and the light flashed on. The creature vanished in the light as if consumed in the warm glow and vanquished by its intervention. My father asked me what was wrong, and I opened my mouth to tell him about the creature, about the being that had studied me every night for as long as I could remember. I felt the words forming in my throat, but then the smallest of doubts sprouted in my mind. I realized how foolish I would seem if I claimed a monster had been hovering over my bed. I could picture my father telling me what I had thought of every night for years. "You're letting your imagination get the better of you." I felt silly now for crying out, for losing control of my senses to a fantasy. I told my father that I had cried out in my sleep because of a nightmare, and that he could go back to bed, I would be fine. My room was dark once again when my father left, and I closed my eyes. I was now convinced that it had been a dream. The creature wasn't real, and it couldn't hurt me. Sleep began to drift over me, my mind falling silent until the creature spoke for the first time. "Your silent tongue belongs to me." The voice was no more than a whisper. It felt thin, but it cut through the air like a knife. The jagged whisper made my arms tingle with fright, goosebumps shooting out of my skin. I knew that if I opened my eyes, I would have to face the creature, so I gave in to my fear and closed my eyes tighter. "Open your eyes." I clenched my eyes even more. "Open your eyes." The force of my eyelids was so great, my vision began to go white from the effort, a mirage of hope. "Will you not face me?" I begged internally for my nightmare to stop speaking. "Very well." Silence hung clearly in the air for a moment. "Your blind eyes belong to me." In one single night, the creature had claimed my eyes and tongue. It kept its promise, and from then on I could only see what the creature wanted me to see. My meals would turn into rotting flesh before my eyes. My teachers became predators hunting me in a desert landscape, and my parents would shackle me into a bed where the creature could spend countless nights observing me. I could no longer sleep unless the creature allowed me to close my eyes. And I watched as its body became clearer and more defined day by day. I watched its muted and pale face sculpt itself slowly. The creature began to grin at me with jagged teeth the color of the night sky. It began to caress my face with long, pale, and greasy fingers. Sometimes the ragged talons of the creature would latch into the skin of my face and carve a long gash into my flesh. The next morning, if someone could see the wounds in my cheeks, they might ask what caused the injury, and the creature would use my tongue to lie. I longed every day to beg somebody to rescue me, to see the horrifying monster that was now following me in broad daylight, but my tongue belonged to the creature, and it would never let me speak of its deeds. I was 16 when my creature began to claw with purpose at my arms and legs, leaving scars that I would cover with my shirts and jeans at its instruction. My creature began to savor the pain that it inflicted, and would spend its nights clawing at me. One night, my creature's eyes suddenly darted from my forearm up to my neck, and I understood what my creature wanted now. It calmly lifted its decrepit hand to my throat and positioned a claw to attack. For the first time, my fear of the creature was silenced for just a moment, and my right hand slipped out of its handcuff and grabbed the creature's wrist, pushing it away from my vulnerable throat. The creature was surprised at my attack and began to push back with equal ferocity, lashing out at its target with an animalistic snarl. My certainty began to waver in the face of this beast and the terror of the moment. Suddenly, all I could see was a future with no end in sight, where every evening I would have to hold my creature's attack at bay. I felt sick and overwhelmed by the promise of fighting this battle every night for the rest of my earthly life, with the only reasonable outcome being my eventual defeat. My hopelessness began to collapse in on itself, and I slowly said out loud, "I don't have the strength for this fight." My creature's attack suddenly ceased as I saw its horrible eyes narrow with uncertainty, its head cocked in an unsettling and inquisitive way, and I slowly let go of my creature's wrist and put my hand back into the shackle. Your idle hands belong to me. I am now 18 years old. I have seen friends, family, and strangers be taken into the abyss by their creatures, disappearing without a trace. I know in my heart that I will one day be taken to experience an eternity of darkness in an unknown world. My creature has taken everything from me, piece by piece, and now only my heart remains. It seems to me that when my heart is claimed, I will fade. What's left of me will be dragged to the edge of that insatiable abyss and be cast inside. I am now 18 years old, and I do not believe that I will ever be 19. All I have left is this hopeless confession. All I have is this story to give you. You will hear my tale. You will consume it, as all are wont to do. Just know that as you consume, I can feel your mind becoming distracted. I can feel you losing focus on the world around you. I can see how your mind is being numbed by this insidious narrative, how your mind has become idle in this story, and how your idle mind belongs to me.
Thank you for listening to this In the Telling Halloween special. You can find out more about In the Telling at LizzyLizzyLiz.com. In the Telling is hosted and produced by me, Liz Christensen. Sleep tight.